All right. Last time we spent the entire lesson talking about Peter's quoting of Joel's prophecy in Joel chapter 2, and how that does not refer to when it says, it shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I'll pour out my spirit or breath on all flesh. Your sons and daughters will prophesy, your young men shall see visions, and so forth. That this is not talking about that prophecy being fulfilled by the coming of the day of Pentecost. But on the other hand, we saw from Joel, the context of the book of Joel, that the prophecy was about the coming of the kingdom and God pouring out his spirit or his breath upon all of the nation of Israel after that national repentance takes place. In Israel, and after God has restored them to the land, and after God has come to dwell among them, that he then says, afterward, I will pour out my spirit or breath upon all flesh. Your sons, your daughters will prophesy. That is, Israel's sons, Israel's daughters are going to prophesy. Now, we should not wrench that out of context. Peter did not rip that passage out of context and apply it to the day of Pentecost. What Peter did was he turned the attention or the focus of the people away from the fact that they were speaking in tongues to the prophecy that Joel had given, which pointed to the coming of the kingdom of God and the blessing, the great blessing, outpouring of blessing that God was going to bring upon the nation of Israel at the time of the kingdom. And that this blessing, what he's going to do now is after he made this quote, is Peter is going to show that this blessing comes through only the Messiah. That is the only way that Israel, the sons and daughters of Israel, are going to be able to participate in this time when God's breath is just overflowing upon his people, Israel, while they're in the land and they have all these abundant crops and all the things that were prophesied there in Joel. The only way that they are going to be able to partake in that abundance of blessing that God had promised was through this one called Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And what Peter's going to do as we continue is he's going to prove to them that Jesus of Nazareth, the one that they crucified, was indeed the Messiah that had been promised, the one who was to bring about all these blessings that we see in the book of Joel when God comes to dwell among his people. And they were in quite a predicament because they had rejected him and they had crucified him. And Peter's point then is that they have no part in the blessing that Joel prophesied that was coming upon, was going to be coming upon Israel in the time of the kingdom. All right, so let's pick that up in Acts chapter 2 in verse 22. This is immediately after Peter had just quoted Joel 2, 28 through 32, and this quote goes from verse 17 here in Acts 2 all the way through verse 21. It's a long quote, but the quote clearly shows that this blessing is promised in association with the coming of the day of the Lord and the cosmic signs that accompany the day of the Lord, the sun and moon being darkened and so forth. All right, so here's what he says, verse 22. After quoting Joel, he says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know." Now, the first thing that Peter points to is the miraculous signs and wonders that God did through Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. Notice the language that he uses here. Does he say that this God, the second person of the Trinity, did when he was here on earth? No. Look what he says. He says, "Men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth." Now, by saying Jesus of Nazareth, he's pointing to his humanity, where he grew up. He grew up in Nazareth, and so that's why he was called Jesus of Nazareth, because in the town of Nazareth, everybody knew him since he was a little child. So he says, Jesus of Nazareth. And then he calls him a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs. Note the next words, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. Now, you see, you can see this kind of language that, and we've talked about this in our module on Christ, on, I think it was module 2, that, and also actually in the life of Christ, that the signs and wonders that Jesus did were not done because of his inherent powers. He didn't have superhuman divine powers whereby he could lay hands on the sick and they would recover, or he could give sight to the blind, or he could raise the dead, or he could calm the sea, or do any of those things. Jesus himself did not have any power to do any of those things. In fact, in John chapter 5, he said, I am unable to do anything from myself. But then he goes on to talk about how the Father was the one doing the works through him. And we see the same thing when Nicodemus came to Jesus by night in John chapter 3, where he says, we know that you are a teacher come from God, because no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. So again, it's not, he's not saying because you are a divine, a deity in and of yourself, but because God is doing the works through you. He's using you as his tool or his instrument to do the works. And this is what we see consistently in the Gospels, and we see it in the book of Acts several times as well in the sermons that are being preached. So let's get back to verse 22. So the first thing he points out in verse 22 is that they were aware of the fact that a man named Jesus, who was from the town of Nazareth, had been going about performing all kinds of miraculous signs and wonders. And he points out the fact that they were aware of this. Now, you know, they may not, some of these people may not have actually seen him do the works, but certainly they had heard about it. And they had talked to eyewitnesses who had seen it. Because many of the signs that Jesus did, he did during the times of the festivals. And the Jews, these particular Jews that he's preaching to here are primarily from all over the Roman Empire who have come for the day of Pentecost. So they might not have been living in the land of Israel, you know, throughout Jesus' whole ministry, but they certainly had been visiting the land, Judea and Jerusalem. They had been visiting there for 3 times a year in order to keep the festivals, right? And Jesus preached for 3.5 years. So they had encountered Jesus, the man from Nazareth, who had been doing these mighty works. So then Peter continues, verse 23. Him, that is Jesus of Nazareth, the one who did all these works, or God did the works through him, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands and have crucified and put to death. Wow. Now, first of all, he says, being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God. God had a purpose in hardening and in blinding Israel so that they would not recognize the coming of the Messiah. In 1 Corinthians chapter, I believe it's 2, Paul talks about how God had hidden this mystery of who the Messiah was and the real nature of who the Messiah was. And he had hidden this mystery in the Old Testament scriptures, and he says, for had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The concealing of who Jesus really was through sort of cryptic language that we see in the Old Testament, and also even Jesus being a little bit evasive in the Gospels when he's asked point blank, are you the Son of God? And he seems to be a little bit evasive about it. But then at other times he makes statements that are very clear, but you have to infer that he was claiming to be the Son of God. He never actually said, I am the Son of God. Right? He just kind of, he forced people to make their own conclusion as to whether he was or not, based on certain things that he said, certain things that he brought up. So he says, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge. And again, the word foreknowledge, don't make the mistake of thinking that foreknowledge means something God knew all the way back from the beginning of time, before any, you know, before these people even existed. Foreknowledge means prior knowledge. That's all it means. And knowing something or some people, knowing people previously or at a prior time, that is while they live, but at a prior time, compared to now. And so what he's saying here is God knew the hearts and the minds of his people. He had prior knowledge. Prior to his son being crucified, God had knowledge of the kind of people that these were. And so God orchestrated events so that certain people would be in power at certain times. The wicked high priest would be in power at that time. Pilate would be in power at that time. God orchestrated events because he knew people's hearts intimately. That's the foreknowledge that is being spoken of here. So he's saying he was delivered by the predetermined purpose and the foreknowing of God. You have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death. Now, if you remember in the gospel accounts when Jesus was brought before Pilate and he was being accused by the chief priests and the scribes and so forth at the temple there, that the way that the Jewish leadership got Pilate to go from saying, I find no fault in this man, and being ready to release him, and he had the power to do that. The way they got him to move from saying that to instead condemning him or handing him over to the soldiers to be beaten and then to be crucified, the way they got him to change his mind was through political pressure. And they basically said, you know, if you let this man go, you're no friend of Caesar, and all that kind of stuff. And so they threatened his job, basically. They threatened to go over his head and make it difficult for him so that the Romans would come down and, you know, take or remove him from his post if he didn't go along. That's the kind of political maneuvering that they were doing. But the way that they put the pressure on Pilate is the same way that we see a lot of political groups, special interest groups, turning up the heat because in order to get their personal political agenda rammed down the throats of the majority of people that don't even agree with them. And that is by getting enough people to make enough noise that somebody's got to do something about it, right? So the old squeaky wheel gets the oil. Metaphor. And so the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests, what they did was they kept whipping up the crowd to get the crowd to cry out, away with him, away with him. We don't want this man to reign over us and all that kind of stuff. So they got the crowds, you know, who are easily led astray by their leaders. See, and this is the problem we have. It was a problem in biblical times. It's the same problem we have in this country. And that is, there are people in leadership roles in various communities, in various political parties, and things like that. And their personal agenda, they have a personal agenda which is very selfish. It's for their own purposes. It's for their own power. But yet, because they're in leadership role, they use their leadership positions to whip up, to lead people based on their emotions and promises and how they're being treated unfairly or whatever it happens to be. They whip up the crowds who then create such a commotion that something has to be done, and so they begin to intimidate. The crowd mentality of intimidating the leaders so that the leaders then will buckle and knuckle under to what these leaders wanted, right? These the scribes and the Pharisees in this particular case. Well, we see this happening all the time, and so it's not surprising that it happened in biblical times as well. And it all boils down to what? Corrupt leadership. Isn't that right? It's corrupt leadership, and that's what all of Isaiah 28 is about. It's about the corrupt leadership of Israel at the time of Christ. So when he says here, him being delivered by the predetermined purpose and foreknowledge of God, he says, you have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death. He's pointing his finger at the common people. He's not pointing his finger at the leadership of Israel. He's pointing his finger at the common people, the people who had come to Jerusalem for the festivals, you know, and then they went back home and went about their lives, and then they come back the next time for the festivals. And at Passover, which was only 7 weeks earlier than this, this is the same crowd that the Jewish leadership had whipped up to get them to, you know, cry out, crucify him, away with this man, and all that, to get, you know, to put the pressure on Pilate so that he would have him crucified. And it's the same crowd that had been so wishy-washy. They didn't know that much about Jesus. They had heard about him. They had, you know, they had heard about his miracles. Some of them might have seen some of the miracles, and they're still kind of undecided about it. But you know what? When the leadership started whipping up the crowds, they just went along with it. They went along with it. They didn't really seriously consider the ramifications of what they were doing. And so Peter's talking to these people, but what he's doing is he's putting the blame for the crucifixion of Jesus on them because they were so easily led astray by their leaders with their own agendas. Anyway, verse 24. Whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death. Now, it was because of this crowd that Jesus was put to death. But in spite of the crowd, God raised him up. Now, this is a very powerful statement that Peter's making here. He is validating the resurrection of Jesus Christ as an eyewitness of that. Whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. That means held permanently by the pains of death. And now he begins to quote from Psalm chapter 16 in order to prove that the Messiah was to be raised from the dead. Now, you have to understand that when he's telling these people, you've heard about this Jesus. You've heard about him going around performing all these miracles, right? You are either an eyewitness or you have heard about it. It's been out there. It's in the news, okay? They had also heard that he had been raised from the dead. That is, now they no doubt were skeptical. Many were no doubt skeptical. But the apostles had been going around saying that he raised from the dead to the point where the leadership had to put out a false story that they stole his body away, right? So the idea that Jesus had been raised from the dead 7 weeks earlier, just, you know, 3 days after the third day from his crucifixion, that was common knowledge as well. And so Peter's pointing that out, and he says, whom God raised, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. Verse 25, for David says concerning him, and now he begins to quote Psalm 16. Now, what I want to do, as I've told you guys in other classes many, many times, is whenever the New Testament speakers or writers quote from the Old Testament and reference the Old Testament, it is critically important that we go back and look at the context of the whole passage, not just take the quote that's contained in the New Testament. Because the traditional way of teaching from the Jewish style was that instead of going through like I did last week, I took you back to Joel, and I went through, you know, a good portion of the book of Joel just to kind of give you the flow of the context. But see, the Jews, they knew all this stuff. They understood the context of Joel. They understood these different psalms and their whole context of them. In fact, they were songs. They sang them at the synagogue, right? So they understood the whole. So when you quote just one little part of it, it brings to mind the whole. It brings the whole context, the whole flow, everything that's being said. It brings it into, it imports it into the discussion or the point that is being made. And so by just grabbing this little piece here and this little piece here, it's bringing all these other passages to bear on the argument that Peter was making. And so we have to see the harmony in all of these passages that are being brought together and how they all fit together. And what does this big picture tell us? Not just the words that are recorded in Peter's sermon, but what does it tell us when we pull all these passages from the Old Testament in their context and we bring them all together and we look at them all, we understand all that's being said in them, and then we look and see what the point is that Peter's trying to make. And so let's go back to Psalm chapter 16 for just a moment. What I want to show you is that the psalm that Peter chose to quote from is a psalm that is talking about the Messiah's inheritance in the kingdom. So let's look at Psalm chapter 16. I'm going to start in verse 5. O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance. Now, who was it that had an inheritance from God? You guys are familiar with Psalm 2 because I repeat it over and over and over again, right? God says to the Son, you are my Son today. I've begotten you, asking me, I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth is your possession. You will shepherd them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel, and so forth, right? So the inheritance is promised to the Son of God, who is also called the Anointed or the Christ in that very same psalm. So this is who is speaking here. David puts words in the Psalms. He puts words in the mouth of the Messiah, even though he has not come yet in human form to fulfill that. David, when he's writing these things as a prophet, he puts the words in the mouth of the Messiah. And he did that in Psalm 2. He's done it in many places. And this is another one of those instances. So, O Lord, verse 5, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. And the word lot here is an interesting word in Hebrew. It literally means the thing that has been portioned out for me. When it's most commonly used in when it's talking about Joshua bringing the children of Israel into the promised land, and it says he divided their land by lot. And so he would give this tribe this portion of land, and he would give that tribe that portion of land. And so the lot was the device that was used to divide up the land so that it marked out which portion of land a particular person or tribe was going to get. And so when it says here that you are the portion of my inheritance, you maintain my lot, it's talking about the portion of land that was promised to the Messiah. And then at verse 6, it says, the lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. The word lines there is not a good translation. I mean, it is in a sense literal, but it literally means the borders. And it's talking about when you draw out on a map, you draw out what the borders of a particular piece of property are going to be, that this is, you know, on this side of the line is yours, and on that side of the line belongs to somebody else. And so anytime you have an inheritance, there were lines which mark the borders of your inheritance, the borders of your property. And that's exactly what he's talking about here. He says, yes, I have a good inheritance. And again, this is all a reference to Psalm 2, the inheritance of the Son. Verse 7, I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the night seasons. This is talking about the Son. It's talking about Christ when, after he was born as a baby and his father was teaching him and instructing him. We see that in Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 through 16, particularly in the Greek version, which talks about how that even from infancy, he was being taught by his father to refuse the evil and to choose the good. So he says, I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. And this, again, these are the words of Jesus himself talking about his inheritance, talking about his relationship with his father as he was growing up. And then in verse 9 it says, "Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope." And here he's talking about his death. "For you will not leave my soul in Sheol." Now, remember, Sheol is the same in Hebrew as Hades is in Greek. And it refers to the grave as a sort of a collective concept for all of mankind. All of mankind is headed for the grave, Hades or Sheol. All right, it's the place of the body, but not talking about your specific hole in the ground. It's talking about the fact that you're going to be buried and that you're going to have the same fate as all mankind, which is the grave. Okay, that's the sense that the word Sheol is used. So he says, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol," or the grave. And again, what is soul? You guys know from my classes, what is soul? Is soul your ghost? No. What is soul? Right? God formed Adam out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his breath, his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. Soul is a physical creature. All right? Animals are souls, according to Genesis. So when he says, "You will not leave my soul," he means my person, my physical person. "You will not leave my soul in the grave. Nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption," that is decay. And the Jews considered decay to occur after 3 days. That is, a person was in the grave, that they began to decompose. And so Jesus was only in the grave for what? Not 3 days. He was raised on the third day. Then he goes on, "You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." So when Peter in Acts chapter 2, he quotes this passage. Now, he didn't quote the whole psalm. We read more of it than he quoted. But the context in which the son is saying, "You will not leave my soul or my person in the grave, or allow your Holy One to see corruption or decomposition," when he's saying that, the context of the passage is talking about how that the Messiah was looking forward to the day when he was going to receive his inheritance, the lines of his inheritance, and how his inheritance and his lot, that is that portion of his inheritance, was so great and so wonderful, and how he was looking forward to that based on Psalm chapter 2. And in all that, knowing that he had to die, Jesus, when he looked towards his death, he looked beyond his death to the hope that the Father was going to raise him from the dead, because he was not going to allow him to stay in the grave and decompose, but he was going to bring him back so that he could partake in the inheritance that the Father had promised to him. That's the context of Psalm chapter 16. And so when Peter quotes that here, he's bringing that to bear on his argument. Even though he doesn't mention the Messiah's inheritance in his quote, he doesn't quote enough of it to include that. That's part of the psalm, and it cannot be excluded from the point that Peter's trying to make. Now, verse 29, Peter now begins to interpret that psalm with regard to the question of, who is this psalm referring to? Right? Is it referring to David? Because it's written in the first person. Look what it says. It says, "I will bless the Lord," verse 7. Verse 10, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol, or allow your Holy One to see corruption." So David writes this psalm as though the words were his. But yet, in fact, as we'll see, Peter is going to tell us that these words that David was writing were not his words. He was prophesying about the Messiah, and that's because the Messiah had been promised to come from David's own body, his own loins. And because the Messiah would be from David's own body, David felt that he could speak for his own descendant, who would be the Christ. And by the holy breath of God, he did, and he prophesied in that way. All right. So he says, verse 29, men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. So the point is, look, if David was talking about himself in Psalm 16, then how come he said that God would not allow his Holy One to see decay, or that he wouldn't let him stay in the grave, that he was going to bring him out of the grave before his corpse began to decompose? That's what the psalm says. So he says, therefore, being a prophet and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his, that is on David's, throne. He, that is David, foreseeing this, that is seeing what God had promised him in the future about his descendant that was going to sit upon his throne and reign over the house of Israel forever, seeing, understanding the promise that was given to him, the covenant, it says, he, foreseeing this, spoke in Psalm 16 concerning the resurrection of the Christ. And that's the Holy One that's mentioned there in Psalms, where it says, you will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. That his soul, or his person, was not left in Hades. And here he uses Hades because he's quoting from the Greek version of the Old Testament rather than the Hebrew. And he's also writing in Greek, or he was preaching in Greek, and his sermon is recorded in Greek. That his person was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. Now, Peter's saying, look, it's clear that this psalm was not talking about David. It's talking about the Messiah. We know it's not talking about David because David is still in his grave. If you go to David's grave, it says his tomb is still with us to this day. If you go to David's grave, you could probably pull the stone away, you know, or pull the slab off the top, or however David was buried, and his bones are still there. So obviously David saw decay. So the passage is not about David. He was putting the words in the mouth of his descendant, who would be the Messiah. So then he says, verse 32, this Jesus was raised up, of which we are all witnesses. Now this is a critical, critical statement. We all of these people that were speaking in foreign languages, speaking the wonderful works of God, speaking how Israel could escape the judgment of God and enter into the blessing of the kingdom that Joel prophesied in Joel chapter 2, when it says that God was going to pour out his holy breath abundantly upon all the nation of Israel and all of them, how they could participate in that thing. He's saying, this Jesus, the one who you heard about, who had been going about doing all these miracles, and now you've heard that he was raised from the dead, and the rumors are going around that people are saying that he was raised from the dead. He's saying, God has raised him up, and we are all witnesses. So, you know, this is a very, very powerful confirmation of the resurrection, because you've got a supernatural manifestation going on by these 120 people. They're speaking in these foreign languages, right? And they're telling these wonderful works of God and talking about the coming of the kingdom and how Israel could enter into the kingdom and escape the judgment that was coming and all that. And so here we have Peter now saying that these same people who are clearly being used by God, that is, God is using their mouths to speak to you in your own languages, all of us are eyewitnesses to the fact that God raised his son from the dead. Now, this is such an amazing sermon, because how could they deny,
right? How could they deny that this was real? They could not deny the miracle. And, you know, this is one of the critical things, complaints that I have against charismatics and Pentecostals, is that is the tongues that they're talking are just gibberish, and there is no apparent miracle in them at all. It's mimicking the gift of tongues. It's not the real gift of tongues. But the real gift of tongues was a miracle that absolutely could not be denied, because these people heard these people who were foreigners to them speaking in all these other languages from all over the Roman Empire, and they knew that they were only Galileans living in Galilee. How in the world could they have learned all the languages of the Roman Empire? How could they do that? It's impossible. It was a miracle, and yet even in these foreign languages, they're proclaiming the coming kingdom of God and how Israel can escape judgment. And now when they say that not only are we doing this thing, you know, this was that flaming tongue on their head being manifested to the crowds, right? God's mighty works that cannot be denied. Don't be fooled by the counterfeit of tongues. Don't be fooled by it. All right. If it's not an undeniable miracle happening right in front of you, don't believe it. All right. That's just a word of warning, because the Bible talks about lying signs and wonders in the last days. Anyway, let's move on from that. So Peter says that we are all witnesses. Verse 33. Therefore, being exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Breath, that is, and the way it's worded here, it's Jesus himself has received the promise of the Holy Breath from the Father, is what it's saying. It's not saying we have received it, all right? That's important. The way the participles and the clauses work here, it's Jesus has been exalted to the right hand of God. Jesus has received from the Father the promise of the Holy Breath. That is, he is the one who has control over the Holy Breath. Now, the same Holy Breath that's going to be poured out upon all the house of Israel in the coming kingdom, it's in his hand. That's what he's saying. And then he says, he, that is Jesus, poured out this which you now see and hear. That is, the one who has the Holy Breath of God, control over the fulfillment of the prophecy in Joel, where in the coming kingdom, when God dwells among men, that the Holy Breath of God is going to be poured out upon all of Israel. The one who holds that promise in his hand in heaven, he's the one who has now given you this little taste of the supernatural, this little taste of what the kingdom may be like because of the mighty power of God. All right, so verse 34, for David did not ascend into the heavens. Again, he's going to show that other psalms that are talking about the Messiah, but yet David, when he wrote them, he spoke as though it was him, just like in Psalm 2, where he says, you know, the Lord says to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, I'll give you the nations for your inheritance. David writes that psalm, and it's if you look at it grammatically, it sounds like he's talking about himself. But yet he's talking about his descendant, the Messiah. He's putting words in the mouth of his descendant. And we have that in Psalm 16, and we also have that in Psalm 110, which he begins to quote here. Now, let me just read verse 34 and 35, and then we're going to go back to Psalm 110 and look at it there. All right. For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now, let's look at the passage in Psalm 110, because again, just as we found in Joel, which was talking about ultimately the promise of the coming kingdom and the abundant blessing that God was going to pour out in the kingdom, just as in Psalm 16, which Peter quoted about Christ to show that he was the heir, the one to receive the inheritance, the one whom God was, who was obviously going to die, but God was going to raise him from the dead, that this is the Messiah. And then Peter saying, look, we're eyewitnesses of this Jesus that you've heard about going around doing miracles, and we're eyewitnesses that he did indeed die and that he did indeed rise from the dead. In other words, he's the one Psalm 16 is talking about. Now the next step is the ascension. Peter's going to prove that the ascension was about Jesus, not about David. The ascension that's promised in Psalm 110. So let's look there. Verse 1. The Lord said to my Lord, that is Jehovah, said to David's Lord, David's master, which is David's son. Also, you may remember the little riddle that Jesus gave the scribes and Pharisees where he quoted this verse and he says, who is the Messiah? Who is the Christ of Psalm 2? Who is he? Is he? And they said, he's David's son. And Jesus says to them, well, if he's David's son, then why does David call him Lord? And he quotes Psalm 110, and they couldn't answer. They couldn't answer because the son was David's Lord, because he was David's creator, and he was also David's descendant when he became man. But anyway, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now, when he makes the enemies of the Messiah his footstool, that's the day of the Lord that Joel was talking about in Joel chapter 2. It's his second coming when he defeats the enemies of Israel, when he restores Israel to the land, when he purges the land of Israel, all that kind of stuff, when the sun and the moon are darkened, and all that takes place. Now, so Psalm 110:1 is about his ascending to heaven and waiting, being seated at the Father's right hand. But then it says, but it doesn't stop there, see? It goes on to say, the Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. That is, after you're seated at the Father's right hand for a little while until it's time for your enemies to be made your footstool, after that, then you are going to rule over your enemies. You're going to send the rod of your strength. So sitting at my right hand is not exercising the rod of his strength. Sitting at his right hand is exercising restraint and not punishing the enemies of Israel. But when the Lord, in verse 2, the Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, and you will rule in the midst of your enemies. That's when he overthrows the enemies and Christ reigns. All right, so then he says, verse 3, your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power, in the beauty of holiness. From the womb of the morning, you have the dew of your youth. The Septuagint says, from before the morning, I have engendered you, or I have begotten you before the morning. That is, before God created day and night, before he did all those other things, he had begotten his son. And this is talking about the beginning of the son on the first day of creation. Anyway, the Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Let's continue. The Lord is at your right hand. He shall execute kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the nations. He shall fill the places with dead bodies. He shall execute the heads of many countries. He shall drink of the brook by the wayside. Therefore, he shall lift up the head. Now, this is the Messiah. He's going to overthrow the kingdoms of the earth. And this is when his enemies are being made his footstool. Okay? So, that's the context of the passage. The whole passage, is not about Jesus just sitting at the Father's right hand and waiting. Yes, it starts that way. But then it goes immediately into the fact that once his time of waiting is over, he's going to reign over his enemies. He's going to destroy his enemies. And he's going to reign along with his people, whom it actually says are volunteers in verse 3, during the time of his kingdom. All right, so let's go back to Acts chapter 2, verse 34, for David did not ascend into the heavens. That is, in Psalm 110, David wasn't, when God says, you know, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool, God wasn't talking to David. He was talking about the Messiah, which is why David said, the Lord, Jehovah, said to my Lord, my master, which is the Messiah, sit at my right hand. So he says, David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and so forth. And by the way, those of you who think that when a person dies, they go to heaven, why didn't David go to heaven? He's dead. Jesus had ascended to heaven 10 days earlier, yet Peter says, David did not ascend into heaven. Shouldn't he be there? No, he shouldn't. But anyway, that's the topic for another day. All right, verse 36. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly. Why assuredly? Because Peter wove together these Old Testament prophecies about the coming kingdom of God, the blessing that would be upon Israel, but yet the judgment also that was coming upon Israel. He wove all these prophecies together, and he showed beyond a shadow of a doubt, using sound reasoning, using good interpretive principles, and of course using the power of the holy breath of God that was upon him, he wove all this thing together into a fabric whereby they could not deny that the very Jesus of Nazareth, whom they had heard about, who had gone about preaching from town to town and doing all these miracles that no one could deny, and now we've got 120 people speaking in foreign languages that they never knew, which was an undeniable miracle, also saying and testifying that they have seen Jesus resurrected from the dead. And if that's true, then Psalm 16 was about him. And if that's true, then Psalm 110 was also about him, which talks about a delay before he establishes his kingdom on the earth. Verse 36, therefore let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. Now when they heard that, they were cut to the heart. And they said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, men and brothers, what shall we do? They crucified the one that Peter had just proven to them beyond any shadow of a doubt was the fulfillment of the prophecies in David about the coming of the Messiah, the one who's going to reign, the one who has the power of the Holy Breath in his very hand to administer that as he sees fit, and the one who is going to pour out of his breath upon the whole house of Israel in the kingdom when God restores the nation. And that very same person they had by wicked hands crucified and slain. And now, after hearing all this, what can they say? What can we do? What can we do? We have been such fools. We have been led astray by our leaders. Well, we'll stop there now, and we'll pick it up next time. Peter's response as to what they can do is essentially the same response for anyone who realizes that they're a sinner, anyone who wants to have an inheritance in the kingdom of God, to be part of that Abrahamic covenant, anybody. The answer is in the next few verses, so we'll talk about that next time.